Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Modern Mind. Today we have four lessons from psychology, taken from four separate psychologists that have appeared on the show before. First of all, we hear from Dr. Julie Smith, clinical psychologist and the author of Why Has Nobody Told Me This Before, talking about the disparity in masculine and feminine views on mental health and what we can do to help a friend if they are struggling. Then we hear from TJ Power, psychologist and neuroscientist, who talks about how we can build healthy relationships with technology and the various chemicals that can affect our behavior and what we can do to optimize them. Next up, we hear from Dr. Daniel Crosby, who is a behavioral finance expert and psychologist, explaining the link between money and happiness and how our experiences can be far more valuable to us than material goods. Finally, we hear from Adam Lane Smith, psychotherapist and attachment specialist, who discusses the difference between male and female behavior and how bonding over problem solving can be the most valuable thing that we can aim for. So expect to understand more about your mental health, expect to think differently about your relationships, and expect to change your perspective on living a meaningful life. But before we get into all that, it is important to request a few things from you. If you haven't yet done so, please do hit the follow or subscribe button, whatever platform you're listening on. Share this episode or an episode previously with a friend. Make sure to rate and or review us on whatever platform you're on. Check us out on YouTube and make sure to hit subscribe there too, as well as signing up to the mailing list in the show notes down below. Thank you very much. So before we hear from Dr. Julie Smith, it is important to mention the show's sponsors, as without them, there would be no show. First up, we have Vivo Barefoot, who have been my shoe of choice for the best part of 3 years now, and that is for a myriad of reasons. But the one that I'm going to really punch you square in the face with is the fact that simply by wearing a pair of Vivos for up to 6 months, you can improve your foot strength by up to 60%, which is a remarkable increase and can carry over to balance, stability, strength on the floor, reinforcing your foundations, building your base. So whether that's injury prevention, whether that's healthy natural movement patterns, whether that's actual strength in the gym, there are simple, tangible benefits to be gained from just wearing and walking around in a pair of Vivos. So why miss out on that opportunity? Along with that, they have the widest range of any barefoot footwear on the planet, which means that whether you're in jeans, whether you're at the gym, whether you're walking the dogs, whether you're walking up hills, you are covered. So if you would like to be covered and supply yourself with a variety of Vivos to choose from, then use the code FergusVivo to save yourself 15% off at checkout. And do please let me know how you get on over socials.
Next up, we have Mancave, who are without a doubt the UK's most exciting men's grooming business. Based out of the Peak District and sold nationwide, they are 100% recyclable, 100% cruelty-free, and 100% natural, which means that you can have confidence in the quality of the product that you are using to look great, smell great, and feel great, which is the most important thing at the end of the day, is it not? They have everything from weird and wonderful smelling shower gels to hair product to black spice body scrub to beard oil and everything in between. And would love it if you guys gave their products a go if you haven't yet done so, as I've been using them for over a year now and really do swear by them. They are much better than a lot of off-the-shelf supermarket brands. And men, if you're listening using a 3-in-1 shampoo, body wash, conditioner thing, then it's time to step up your game because we're not teenagers anymore and you deserve better. So, if you're looking to capitalize on how much you deserve better, then use the code FC40 at checkout to save yourself 40% off, and please let me know how you get on over social media.
Anyway, without any further ado, let's dive into today's episode and explore four powerful lessons from the world of psychology. How would you summarize your perspective on the disparity between masculine perception of mental health and more feminine perception of mental health in terms of the ultimate statistics that men are more susceptible to keeping these things quiet, more susceptible to the act of suicide, and something that's obviously very personal to me from that point of view, but I have the understanding from a personal perspective, but it'd be very interesting to hear a clinical overview of the things that you've picked up on.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because of the kind of experiences that I've had, you know, even sort of before I qualified, when I was specialising and I was doing all the stuff with the MOD and working with soldiers and stuff, and there were certain approaches that seemed to sort of lend themselves more to that sort of audience, if you like, you know, certainly. There was a for I don't want to say all men, but those men in particular, they liked to have a clear idea of like, what's the homework, what do I need to do, and this will make it better and stuff. to have a sort of clear, concrete plan. Those kind of things are very practical and stuff. But then, you know, later, you know, there was that experience. But then later on, even doing this stuff, 75% of my audience are female. So, and I don't have the crystal ball or the data to suggest that that is for any particular reason it might be that's because, you know, it fits with the stats that men don't like to talk about these kind of things, but also maybe they're following someone else. Maybe men prefer to hear that information from a man, and that would be fine. You know, you've only got to look at the following of someone like Jordan Peterson, for example, and that it's mostly men that follow him, and he's a clinical psychologist. So there could be that. There could be that those things influence it. So yeah, I don't think I have the sort of full answer, really. I think things are shifting. I think historically there has been this sense of masculinity involves not engaging with emotion and not acknowledging it, let alone working on any of it. And yet in this sort of new era where you have access to education around this stuff and people are talking more and more openly about it, you know, I've come across these incredible people that have approached me along the way. A good friend of mine called Joe, who was in the Special Forces, and through his own experience has now, you know, devoted his career to creating opportunities for people to access therapy online in a way that is branded towards men and those masculine men from, you know, his type of background from the Special Forces, where they were probably put off by all the pastel colors and the idea that it's a very feminine thing. So I think we're in a time where massive change is happening. You know, there are brave people like yourself who are swimming against the tide and saying, do you know what, this is something that's okay to talk about. You can be a really masculine, strong guy who other people can look up to, and you can also be strong enough to tackle, you know, mental health issues as well as physical health issues, and that the two should be no different. And you can't be the strongest man you want to be without looking at both of those and making sure they're both you know, tip top. So I think, you know, people like you are making that massive difference for men that probably people like me can't do so much, because you can be that role model.
I the role model is, funnily enough, the thing that I reference most when I reflect on probably the earlier stages of when I started to go downhill, is that I felt very, very isolated and unique for feeling the way that I did, because I couldn't identify with any men that I felt I looked up to that were open and honest about this sort of thing. So I think from a personal point of view, that's something I try and put across. But more importantly, people like Joe, the Special Forces are pretty hard blokes, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
So them talking about this is very much bringing down that entry point for people so that there's more role models out there. And like we were speaking about offline before, you can't really use the straw man argument of, oh, well, talking about mental health makes you weak, when you've got Special Forces blokes, when you've got England rugby captains, when you've got this, when you've got that, people talking about it, it does bring that gap closer and closer. And I do think the tide is turning, which is fantastic. It's just interesting to hear your perspective. So before we move on to the real big question that I know you finished the book on, and the one that I think everybody's hoping to leave today's conversation with the answer to on how to live a meaningful life, what are the lowest hanging fruits from an empathy point of view, from an impact point of view, that people listening can take away to have an impact on those around them on a day-to-day basis? Granted that obviously they need to have their own self-awareness, they need to be in a position where they're comfortable. What are the things that we can do to have an impact, which will then hopefully have that trickle-down effect to really, really tackle this crisis head-on in the UK and beyond?
In terms of sort of supporting people who are struggling with their mental health?
Yeah.
I think there's a few things here. I think there is, I would say, I mean, I've made a video on this recently, try not to get into that trap of becoming the rescuer. There is that tendency, the most natural human response when someone you love is struggling is to try and scoop them up and fix whatever it is that's causing them pain and make it all go away. And often, while that makes us feel good because it eases our discomfort that we can't fix this, it can be almost disempowering for the person who's going through their own process and their own journey. And that doesn't mean don't support them, but support is best when it enables kind of recovery. So let's say, let's say someone's really struggling and it part of their therapy is to make sure they get out for a walk every day. But they're still managing to cook, right? They're still managing to make themselves meals every day. If someone then goes into that environment and says, don't worry about the cooking, I'll cook for you, I'll bring your meals around, da, da, da. You've taken that thing from them. It feels like you're doing a nice thing, but essentially that was something they were managing. And then once that's taken away from them, they then have to think about putting that back in place. It becomes another rung of the ladder to work on. Whereas if you come around and say, oh, that walk you need to do every day, I'll meet you at the end of the road and we'll go together. You know, you're helping them to make the things happen that need to happen for them to recover. So often it's a great way to kind of support people is helping them practically do the things they need to do for their recovery, rather than kind of scooping up and trying to make it all go away. But also don't put yourself on this pedestal of needing to be the therapist, right? It's a profession in itself, and you don't have to know exactly what to say and how to say it to get it right and to be a good support for someone. And gosh, when I've worked with people who are in the depths of despair, and maybe they're, I don't know, let's say someone is grieving and they're in pain all the time, but they have this friend that pops round every couple of days and they go out for a walk together, and while they're walking, or they go out for coffee together, and during that time they don't really talk about the thing, but they talk about everything else, and they have a laugh and a joke and this TV program they've been watching, and it becomes, I know I've had people who have said, oh, it's just sometimes it's the best part of my week because it gives me this window where I just forget for a minute, and it gives me this moment of replenishment and a bit of rest from the pain. And it's okay to be that friend. If you don't feel able to talk openly and ask the questions because you're afraid that you can't contain any emotion that might come up, it's okay if you don't feel skilled to do that. You can support in other ways. And so, because I think tendency for a lot of people is to withdraw because they think, I don't want to say the wrong thing, I don't want to make it worse, and I have no idea how to help. It's okay to help in your own way. And it's okay to ask someone as well. Like, if, you know, gosh, sometimes the best thing to say is, I really care about you and it matters to me that you recover and you get better. But I have no idea how to support you. What would be the best way I could help you right now? What would be the best things I could do? And tell me when I get it wrong, and I won't take it personally because this matters to me, and I, you know, I want to support you. So it's okay to ask those questions and kind of, you know, it's the elephant in the room thing. Just say it, name it. If you feel like you're worried about saying the wrong thing, say that, because people will get it.
To use your previous analogy, it's just reinforcing, get in the pit with them rather than to extend the metaphor you've just given for no real reason, but I've committed here. Rather than chucking them a rope down and then just sort of helping them out, it's getting in there and helping them understand, because that might give them the strength to get out with you, or it might just distract them from the reality of the situation. Empathy is the real buzzword, and I think that's what I've found to be most effective, because even if it doesn't work straight away, especially bloke to bloke, I've got a lot of experience speaking to blokes that are still resilient to this sort of thing. Even if you just show that you understand, whether they vocalize that to you or not, that will help them better process the situation they're in, because it'll make them think, okay, there's somebody there that gets it. Yeah. Maybe this allows me to think about it. And if I can't understand it anymore, I can talk about it with them again. It gives them that channel. The final chapter of the book, the drawn out conclusion of the book is the big question, how do we live a meaningful life? And if you were to summarize that chapter and the things that people can take away from it to live a meaningful life in their own lives, what would that look like?
I think start with that idea that where I talked about the things like the values check-ins is take the time to ask yourself those questions about, you know, no one gives you the meaning. You decide what that meaning is going to be and what matters to you and what gives you such a sense of purpose. You know, when you find something in your life that you see as so important, that matters so much that it's worth being uncomfortable for, then that gives you that kind of thread of this purpose to sort of follow through life. And I think people are, maybe there's a sort of misconception around, you know, social media and stuff that you need to have this epiphany moment and you just, you know, you discover that this one thing is really important to you. It doesn't always happen like that. Like I didn't have some epiphany moment that where I found out that this was my life's path. I followed my interests to begin with, and I just found humans fascinating, and so I loved studying psychology and reading it for pleasure and that kind of thing. So it doesn't mean you have to know from a young age what your life's purpose is going to be. It means that you're always curious as to this point in your life, what seems to matter most at the moment, and what does that mean in terms of how you want to live your life and the kind of person you want to be and how you want to face the different challenges. And then keep reassessing, keep going back to that, because that value system will change over time. And I think when I did the Stephen Bartlett podcast, there was a question around, you know, how can we know what that meaning is, like really early in life, so that we go on the right path? And it just doesn't work like that. You know, you're never going to have the same set of values when you're 17 as when you're 45. You know, the kind of as you go through life and your circumstances change, your values will change. As you develop and mature, your values change as well, and that's okay. You just got to stay in touch with them and reevaluate them. So I would say keep doing those little values check-ins that I talked about, and asking yourself what matters, but then turn it into concrete behavioral action so that you are living in line with it and not just thinking about it.
From your experience and from an understanding of the science and understanding the people behind the science, the people, i.e. you and me, everybody else, how in the modern world do we cultivate healthy digital relationships?
Yeah, so the biggest thing to understand is technology has a huge effect on this dopamine chemical. Dopamine is so vital for us as a human being. Dopamine's the chemical that is fundamental to keeping us alive. That's why you have it within you. It's basically to motivate you towards behaviors that are going to keep you alive. So if you go back in the day, it might have motivated you to hunt or forage for food or connect with people or build shelter. It's like this really core motivating chemical. And when we, over hundreds of thousands of years, experienced the dopamine reward, it would have been heaven, because these are the most sought after things, like successfully finding food or building shelter or having kids or having sex. These are the moments we felt the best. And over time, we've began to basically realize, oh, maybe we can get that dopamine hit without having to put in tons of effort. But the challenge is, when you have a normal natural dopamine hit that you'll experience, maybe when you're exercising and you're pushing yourself, these kind of things that earn reward, you have these nice gentle fluctuations in dopamine. When we look at, say, social media, for example, it's immediate pleasure straight into our brain. Like, we go into TikTok and it's like, wow, that's so entertaining, or wow, she's really good looking, or wow, that was really funny, or whatever it may be. And dopamine spikes fast. So dopamine goes up really quickly as soon as you go on social media, rather than a gentle climb. When dopamine spikes up fast, it's forced to drop below your baseline level in order to kind of get back to its equilibrium. And it's in this below baseline level that our mind goes into difficulty, because you can imagine, if this chemical is designed to keep us alive and we're low on it, the system's not going to feel that good. So with your question of how do we cultivate the healthy relationship with the tech, it's all about frequency of usage and duration of usage when you're on it. So if we're really frequently checking it, like if we're working and then every 5 minutes, little scroll on social, you're never giving your dopamine a chance to climb back. So frequency is really important. So having prolonged periods of time off of the tech, and I teach this whole digital detoxing concept. And then also when you're on it and when you're thinking, oh, it's end of the day, like I definitely deserve a nice scroll on social media, which is all good. Like, I also love doing that. It's just don't do it for too long, because there's the longer you're in there, just the same as don't drink too many drinks, but it's all right to have some drinks. It's the same concept. If you drink 10, you're going to feel pretty crap the next day. If you drink 2, you'll probably be all right. So frequency and duration is kind of the key with building a healthy relationship.
It's fascinating as well, because my understanding of sort of recreational drugs in general is that a come down is where you sit below that equilibrium for longer.
Yeah.
You've gone so aggressively below. So to put it into sort of realistic terms, obviously it's a much more aggressively spiked in one direction and then the other with that sort of thing when it comes to synthetic drug use. But it's the same mechanism, isn't it? In terms of day-to-day human interaction in our brain, it's the same thing happening.
Exactly the same thing happening. And a recent discovery that I've been really researching, and there's a chap called Andrew Huberman. You may have heard of him. He's kind of becoming the king in neuroscience now. There's this whole concept that when you're below baseline in dopamine, you're not going to feel that good. Really low dopamine, you're going to be looking at things like depression, experiencing really low mood. That depression from the neurobiological perspective, when you can't be bothered to do anything, can't be bothered to get out of bed, can't bother to eat, all of these kind of things, you're low in that driving energy, that driving dopamine chemical. So typically, I've always been looking down this narrative of you don't want to be below baseline dopamine because low dopamine is not going to feel good. Your brain also has an additional chemical when you're going below baseline called dynorphin. When you go below baseline, dynorphin releases into the system, which actually gives additional psychological pain, mental stress, anxiety, whatever it may be, as a mechanism to try and reinforce something wasn't right with what you just did to me there. You took me too high, too fast. So I'm going to add in this chemical to please say, don't do this to me again. So that is when you have the big crash after a long TikTok scroll, or the crash after alcohol, or the crash after junk food, crash after porn, when you actually feel extra crap, it's because of this dynorphin chemical is coming in to try and say, please stop doing this.
So I hadn't heard of dynorphin before right now, so I'm immediately incredibly fascinated. And it is it's a deterrent. It's an inherent deterrent that we all have as human beings to not negatively or not reinforce negative behavioral patterns, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah,
And
exactly that, which is fascinating how clever this thing is that we're living in.
very much so. And I often talk about how I try to be not to the point of making life boring and analytical, but I try and be very analytical about the decisions I make on a day-to-day basis. And we are what we consistently do, and the decisions I make in terms of I very rarely drink on a recreational basis now because I know it affects my sleep, I know it affects my overall circadian rhythm, but I also know that there will be social occasions where I will enjoy having 12 beers. And what I do
It can
now
happen.
is I factor in the surroundings and the lifestyle decisions and the broader metrics around that, rather than being so black and white about things, because I can analyze how I feel either side of these. And I know on a day-to-day basis, if I'm not drinking booze recreationally, then I will feel better. But I also know if I miss out on a social occasion, then and I don't buy in, I'll spend the whole day thinking, oh, I'd just be in this weird headspace. So what do I do? I look at it analytically, and then make informed decisions. But that informed decision comes from the analysis that I've made about previous decisions. So it's interesting to know that there is an actual chemical that is accentuating that within my brain.
100%. And it's super interesting because I'm sure you've heard of the endorphins chemical before. That's the one that really is designed to reduce pain, physical pain, and also psychological pain within us. So, from a evolutionary perspective, the absolute core function of that chemical is if you were suddenly, I don't know, faced with fighting a bear or something. I mean, it'd have to be quite a small bear to have a chance. But if you were fighting a small bear and it scratched you, endorphins would release into your system in order to reduce the pain of that scratch so that you'd have a chance of surviving that situation. Similarly, if you're running away from an animal, it would release to reduce that pain. So whenever you're pushing yourself really hard and you're physically pushing yourself, endorphins are going to come in to reduce the pain you're going through. Endorphins, very selectively, is the opposite word to dynorphin. So endorphins are reducing pain within us. Dynorphins are adding pain to us. So they're kind of sisters guiding one another.
So it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I'm now reflecting. Alcohol seems to be the buzzword here, but if you're reflecting on a hangover, which is something the majority of the UK
It's a big topic.
have experienced, is you can often find that you lean into negative behavior patterns even when you don't feel as bad as you expected to, because you are by definition hungover that day, and that's potentially allowing dynorphin to beat you that day. But there might be instances where it's right to work against it, because obviously resetting that equilibrium is the priority when we are in that situation. So should we always take the lessons from dynorphin, or are there times where there are methods and things that we can do to try and reset and get ourselves back to equilibrium faster?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's kind of two sides of dopamine. Dopamine will always return to baseline if it's left. If you do nothing, it will always come back on its own eventually, as long as you're not harming it further. So if it's really low, a waiting game will bring it back. So on a hangover, you could do nothing and eventually you'll come back. If you wanted to speed up the time in which dynorphin leaves the system and dopamine returns to baseline, it very simply follows a rule that if you do things that are effort, you're going to experience a reward of dopamine. That's the core function. It's just to make us put an effort to our life. So even if you take something as simple as cleaning your home. Like you think, oh, I really need to clean the bathroom and the kitchen, or I need to redo my bedroom or my cupboard. These are things that are effort. But typically when you do them, it's like, oh, actually quite satisfying that I've done that. It's like that feeling of accomplishment. So on a hangover, the best thing you can possibly do is just do a few things that are a bit of effort, a bit of cleaning, a bit of movement, cooking yourself a good meal, something like that. Effort is going to basically get you back faster than doing nothing.
Interesting. Very interesting, because it's something that, again, without knowing the science behind it, I've intuitively sort of picked up on over the years that this is a better thing to do in this situation. Mm-hmm. Do this more, Fergus. And from a more relevant example at the moment is I'm in a bit of a slump, which I anticipated and have learned to experience. So post-Keltman, which is the most recent podcast that I spoke about my reflections on, it was... Yeah. Almost a fortnight ago now, but I know there is this phenomenon of post-event depression, post-event slump, whatever you want to call it. I don't want to coin it as post-event depression because it's very temporary and it's you can anticipate it, but it's that culmination of hard work equals reward that comes to an end. And even though I know there's more on the horizon, I know that I've got plans for what's next. I'm straight back into a working day. I'm straight back into training. I'm straight back into eating habits, all these things. The previous thing that was such a fundamental component of my day-to-day life is now gone. So whilst that void has been filled, the reward has been received, and there's that slump that's come from that spike upwards. So for me, it's understanding what can I do in these post-event periods, which is always going to be improving. I'm always going to learn from. What are the habits and the things that I can do to try and bring myself back to the optimal position, away from that slump? And it's things like getting straight back into a positive training regime and having that mapped out beforehand. It's having all my food bought from the supermarket before I get back from the event, because I will just move away from, I'll just think, oh, you've worked hard. Oh my God, a fortnight's passed and you haven't been to the shops. Just little things like this. And it's trying to get ahead of it. And I've picked up on that over time, but I am still, to be honest, coming out the back end of a little bit of a period of a slump, but I knew that was coming. So it was a 15-hour race, so it was a very big day out for context for people that are listening. But it's the same effect in many ways, because it's the result of a prolonged period of effort. And that can manifest itself in people's day-to-day work, their work relationships, their family relationships, can't it? So it's a constant case of analyzing how you respond to certain things and then trying to better prepare as a result of the learnings from that for next time when those things come along. And from a scientific point of view, it sounds like you've just equipped me with all the information I need to better understand that, which is fantastic.
That is good. I think... it is something important to recognize, because the process of dopamine, what's actually really interesting is we've always thought of it as just like a reward chemical, like we do something and then we feel good afterwards. In a lot of the more innovative research that's coming out now, the most pleasurable experience of dopamine is actually in the pursuit, not in the reward of the goal. So it's actually during the Keltman, when you're really pushing yourself, and during all of the training up to it, that you're actually going to experience more of the high. And then when you hit that peak point of dopamine, that the dopamine's been there helping you with the pursuit, and it's like, oh, the system is done, I've managed to complete this. It is just going to think, finally, I can drop myself back lower towards baseline, just like the other side it wants to normally climb. And it is going to fall. So often, whether it's pushing yourself like physically and psychologically, of course, in that situation, or it could be, I even remember this, like working really hard for my A-levels and having this big moment, like thinking, oh my God, it's going to be amazing when I finish. And then afterwards, almost crashing out a bit and thinking like, where's this big reward feeling that I was expecting to come?
There's no fireworks. What's this about?
I know. But often the most pleasurable experience is actually in the pursuit of the goal, which is, I think, quite a motivating factor. If you know that pleasure is in pursuit, I think it can motivate you to pursue what you're seeking for even harder, because you know that the joy is in there.
It's process, not goal oriented, and I think a lot of people. No, I don't want to paint with a broad brushstroke, but I think a lot of conversations I have with athletes, aspiring athletes, is that they have a goal in their head that they aspire to get to, but when you actually dig a little bit deeper as to why they want to set that goal, it's because of things in their day to day life that they want to alleviate or rectify. And I get so much more value from setting a terrifying goal and then knowing what the next 6 months of that journey are going to do for me as an individual. So that actually when I get to the goal itself, it's just, right, let's get it done, rather than having that pressure. So it's a pressure management tactic as well that I find very useful, because if you've gained everything that you were going to gain from the process and you acknowledge that the process is just as valuable as the goal itself, then the goal itself is just the cherry on top. And from a self-development point of view, the big question I always ask is, as long as you've done everything that you believe you could in the run-up to, within the context of your individuality, job done. execute.
100%.
Simple as that. So from a, going back to the sort of the day-to-day stuff, you've mentioned obviously the differences in the baseline chemicals that we need to understand, but are there any other chemicals that are useful to understand before we dive a little bit more into how people can manage this from their own perspective? Because as you mentioned, dopamine is understood one way. Media and general narrative around this tends to make it very linear, whereas it's obviously much more complex than that. So do you want to just almost go through a definition of terms as such before we dive into how people can manage this better at home?
Yeah, for sure. So you want me to stay within dopamine or explain the four that I think are important?
The four that you think are important, yeah. I think. Just really lay it out, because obviously we've covered them already, but some people might be listening and trying to track back thinking, which one's that again?
Yeah, cool. So this is a really nice, easy way to remember it. So what we have, this is a very fortunate thing that I realized about 3 months ago with these words. So you have four key chemicals that are really, really key. These are what your body biologically wants to be in harmony. If they're not in harmony, we don't feel as good. If they are, we feel bloody awesome. So you have dopamine at the top. Dopamine is your motivation. It's wanting you to basically put effort into your life. When you do things that crash out your effort and give you immediate pleasure, it goes lower. When you put in lots of effort to your job or your work or your relationships, it goes higher. The next one you've got is oxytocin. Oxytocin is designed to connect us together as humans. It's most predominantly released in the human experience when a mother gives birth. Both the mother and the child experience this huge spike in oxytocin, which creates maternal bonding. It then is experienced loads throughout our life, any time in which you're deeply connecting with people or deeply connecting with yourself. So it really connects into the self-talk and the internal relationship. So you've got dopamine, then you've got oxytocin, then you've got serotonin, which is the one responsible for, really, like, from a psychological perspective, it's all about our mood and our happiness and our emotional state. From what kind of behaviors help it, it's really the chemical that wants us to be hunter-gatherers tearing through the forest. Like, when you look into what kind of things help your serotonin, it's basically nature, sunlight, movement, gut health, and sleep. So basically being out in the outdoors and behaving in our instinctive way recharges the system, boosts our emotional state. And then our final one is endorphins. So that's the pain tolerance one, when you physically push the body really hard. And if you look down that list, you've got dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, endorphins. Down the side of those letters, it spells dose, which is heaven. So you basically want to be thinking, am I getting my dose of chemicals each day? Am I doing something that's effort? Am I doing something that connects me to myself or others? Am I doing something that connects me with my instinct? So am I getting outside? Am I getting into natural light first thing? Anything like that? And then am I doing something that physically uses my body? Because they've got to be used. That's why we've got them.
Societally, aside from bills and sustenance, why does money drive us so much?
Why does money drive? Oh, this is a great question. Well, I mean, it's like liquid happiness. I think, you know, most of the things that matter most in life, you know, love, friendship, success, like all of these things that we're striving to kind of get our arms around are sort of ephemeral. They're sort of hard to get your arms around. They're hard to quantify. They're hard to define. But man, money, you can stack it. You can pile it up. You can measure it. And you can have this serve as a stand-in for all the things that really matter in life. So I think, you know, there's many reasons why we pursue it so vehemently. But one of the, I think the biggest reasons is it's become a stand-in for all that's good in life.
I've heard you talk about the hierarchy of almost taboo subjects in the Western world. So there's sex, there's work, there's salary, there's all these things going on that we kind of don't really want to share with the stranger we've just met to our right or our left. But money actually stacks at the highest, doesn't it, in terms of what drives us? And was it some brain mapping or some sort of technology that mapped actually how we responded to thinking about money?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's a functional MRI, so a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, which is just a brain scan machine, right? And so when they look at the excitatory power of different conversations, right, like basically how much is your brain firing when you talk about sex or religion or death or politics, any of these sort of big taboo subjects, money has more excitatory power than any of the others. And you even see that play out anecdotally. I mean, I think there's very, very few couples who would get married without, you know, if not having had sex, not have at least talked about sort of their attitudes around sex. But we know that 12% of married couples have never had a conversation about money. And 36% of young people, millennials in relationships, fight about money every single week. So even more than these other taboo topics, money is kind of the last taboo.
It's fascinating. It's such an essential component of our existence, but it's also one of the most inflammatory in many ways. And it kind of begs the question, it's the big one. What is the relationship between money and happiness? Because we've heard it said for years, I think there was a study that estimated in the UK that about £70,000 or above would give you the security that you needed for the security that would equal happiness to some degree. Let's say it's £80,000 to account for current inflation, which is chaotic. But with that in mind, do you find truth in that? As a, obviously, it's dependent on the individual, but how do you view the relationship between happiness and money from your psychological understanding?
Yeah, so the study you're talking about was done at Princeton here in the US, and it did, we're about one for one now with dollars and pounds. So yep. it found that it was $75,000. And again, that's a few years old. So, you know, call it 80 or 90 or whatever now, God, 125 with inflation being what it is now. But basically they said, look, there's a dramatic rise in happiness up to about $75,000, right? So someone who makes $25,000 is much less happy than someone who makes $50,000. And it goes up steeply up to about $75,000. And then it doesn't totally fall off, but it dramatically plateaus at $75,000. And so what psychologists call this is what's called a hygiene factor. And, you know, I think about other types of hygiene, right? Brushing your teeth or something, like, you know, does brushing your teeth make you happy? Like, not really, but like failing to brush your teeth will make you quickly pretty miserable. And money's the same way, like, right? If you've got enough money to live in a warm home and to eat healthy food and send your kids to a safe school, that's about it. That's about what money can do. And after that, it's up to sort of other factors. Now, I'll put a caveat on that, because we know that there are ways that we can spend money to induce happiness. And there's a couple that reliably sort of tick that box. One of them is spending money on other people, right? Like giving a gift, being charitable, being philanthropic. That makes us happy. Getting out of doing stuff we hate makes us happy. So like I haven't cut my yard in a decade, right? Like I just, as soon as I had enough money to pay someone to do my yard, that was gone. And I'm very, very happy to let someone else mow my grass when it's, you know, 100 degrees here in the summertime. And so, and then the final way is spending time with people we love, right? And having experiences. So, you know, me going to Scotland, like that would bring me happiness because it's new and I meet new people and I try new food, you know, and I have new experiences. So travel makes us happy. Experiences with people we love make us happy. Getting out of stuff we hate makes us happy. And being good to other people makes us happy, even beyond that $75,000 mark.
It's something I can attest to from the way I manifest most of my work life, because a lot of it's actually built around experience, and that's what gives me joy and happiness, because it's done with people that I enjoy doing it with. But then the flip side of that is we know that experiences make us happy, but we are also told and somewhat hardwired through society to believe that material goods will also make us happy. So what is the actual relationship between our psychology and the desire for material goods? It's hedonic adaptation. It's something that's constantly adjusting over time, isn't it? Because you get that new watch, you get that new car, and then it's all of a sudden, right, what's next? What's next? What is the hardline relationship between our psychology and material goods?
It's a great question. So if you think about our evolutionary roots, right, we're not really wired for enough. Because our brains are, whatever, 200,000 years old, give or take, and we haven't had an upgrade these many hundreds of thousands of years. And so we are wired for a very different place and time where you could not accrue enough physical wealth to be set for life, right? When you're a hunter-gatherer, right? When you're living on the plains of Africa, right? You can't have enough food, have enough sustenance that you're just good for life. You can now, like you can get there with money. Many people do, but we're not wired for that. We're wired to always be hunting, always be gathering, always looking for that next hit of enough and never quite getting there. Now, so why is it that material goods don't satisfy us in the way that travel does or that experiences do? If I get a new car, right, or a new house, right, I'll just use the example of my house. When I bought this house 7 years ago, it was the nicest house I couldn't believe, like my good fortune, right? I just couldn't believe it was such a blessing. I was so happy. And I still like my house fine, but now it's just where I throw my dirty underwear, right? Like, I mean, now it's just the place where I live. It's just the backdrop of everything. We very quickly become acclimated to material goods. Like your brand new red Porsche is quickly just your car, right? It's just quickly like how you get to work. We very, very quickly acclimate to material things. If I fly over to Scotland though, right? That's brand new. The people I've never met before. The food I've tried, I've never tried before. Like the scenery, the architecture, all of it's brand new. And that newness sticks with us and satisfies our cravings in a way that our tendency to acclimate to material goods never will. And it's kind of backwards of how we think about it. Because you go, oh, if I get a new car, like, you know, I'll keep that for 10 years. Right. If I go to Scotland, that's over in a week, but it's not. It actually works in reverse.
Cutting off access seems important, doesn't it? Because it allows you to experience the initial thrill and then no more. And then that will stay with you as a memory. So to use your example, it's almost like renting the red Porsche to do a track day once a quarter rather than having it in the driveway, which is a fascinating way to look at things.
Well, 100%. And again, you go back to how the mind works, right? If you purchase the red Porsche, right? It starts off perfect. Then some people ding your door. You get in a fender bender. I live in a crazy traffic town, right? It's like you get in a fender bender. The salt on the road, you know, mars your paint job. Like the quality of the car gets worse and worse and worse. The technology gets more and more dated. If you rent the Porsche once a quarter, you can get the brand new one. And your memory, we engage in something called rosy retrospection. So when we look back on a vacation, right? Like I just took my kids to Disney World a couple of months ago. Like in the moment, was it fun? Like, yeah, it was kind of fun, but it was also hot as hell and super expensive and, you know, all these other things, and they're whining and their feet hurt. But when you remember that experience and you look at the pictures, all you remember is the good stuff. You remember the roller coasters and the great food and the time together. And the bad stuff sort of goes by the wayside when you're remembering a trip or a memory. When you're looking at your Porsche in your garage and it's got fading paint and cracked leather, it's right there in your face. So the way that our memory works makes experiences better over time.
With your background in psychology, what would your perspective be on that rosy retrospection when it comes to people that are in this cycle of looking forward to the next holiday, the next experience, as a way of escaping the day job? Because surely, inherently, that's quite an unhealthy behavior pattern to be relying upon if you're always waiting for the next hit of something whilst not actually being able to enjoy the process of getting there, if that makes sense. Surely. The rosy retrospection is fantastic if you're happy in your day-to-day life because it's something you can look forward to and implement into your day-to-day life. But if you're caught in this cycle of enjoying your time away and then not enjoying your time not away, how can people mitigate and get out of that trap, out of that cycle? Because I know there's thousands of people worldwide, millions of people worldwide that will be in that cycle where they're not enjoying their day job and the next trip away is all they've got to look forward to.
Yeah, I don't know that they're mutually exclusive. So like the rosy retrospection thing just happens. Like that's just the way we're wired. Like we hang on to the good stuff. We let the bad stuff slide. I mean, the same stuff happens when someone dies, right? Like when someone you love dies, it's like all the good memories get elevated. The bad stuff kind of falls away. So rosy retrospection sort of is what it is. Like, but what you're talking about of sort of living this life of quiet desperation where you're just slogging through the workday to get to your next vacation. I think that's a miserable way to live, and we need to do better. But I don't know that those two things necessarily go together or conflict with each other. But there's certainly plenty of folks doing that. And money is one of the big reasons why, right? But sometimes the reasons people are slogging through that day job they hate is because they're living beyond their means, or they're not using money in the way that it was intended to bring maximum happiness, or they're engaging in some of these wrong-headed ideas that we've talked about that they think are going to bring them happiness that ultimately don't.
You talk a lot about the relationship between vasopressin and oxytocin. So from a practical side of things, what's the difference? And from an understanding side of things, how do we use that
information? So oxytocin is warmth, care, nurturing. It's when your mom gives you a hug. It's when you high five. It's when you pat your buddy on the back. It's when you snuggle with your sweetheart under a blanket. When you have a good conversation, you get accepted. Oxytocin is the hormone release that bonds you to the other person in an absence of stress. It's when there is no stress, you bond to them because it's so warm and caring. Vasopressin is when there is stress and the two of you resolve it together. So this could be in the military, right? A unit storming a hill and taking that hill together. This is why military buddies stay buddies for life, even if they didn't like each other at the start. It is overcoming challenges together. It is going through hell together and coming out the other side. It could be putting together a piece of furniture, an IKEA bookshelf, or if you survive the experience together. It could be as simple as going to a shooting range and teaching each other a skill, or taking a class together. Going through a new experience that stress bonds you to each other by solving it together is vasopressin. And your brain needs to understand you can cooperate with other people to really get that vasopressin. It's absolutely crucial. Men also, by the way, have more vasopressin receptors than women do. And if you have a difficult childhood, your brain, where you don't get much oxytocin, your brain will shift your oxytocin receptors to instead function as vasopressin receptors. So you will be even more loaded into vasopressin.
What's interesting there is the first thing that jumped out to me is I'm currently spinning a lot of plates. And to be honest, I have not prioritized social interaction as much as I should. And day to day, I occasionally feel the ramifications of that. And it's something I want to improve. But with what you've just said there, it's made me think that maybe with my male friends, I should endeavor to do things that are more challenging and more out of the box, because it will actually form stronger bonds, stronger connection. And if I'm going to be strangely Western world and almost applying economic theory to this, I'll get more bang for my buck with the social interaction in terms of what's actually netted. Because I'm thinking back to the people I have the strongest connections with, and generally it's those that have been a part of the big endurance events I've been a part of, because there's a process, there's a planning, there's a shared suffering, there's a how do we get over this speed bump that's been put in front of us. And those are the strongest bonds I currently have in my life. So we might have created a life hack whereby if you are struggling for time with your male friends in a social setting, go and play Scrabble or do something that's a little bit more problem oriented, because it will form stronger bonds through the mechanism of vasopressin.
That's what men are built to do. We are designed by nature to do that. So if we lean into that, we will definitely get more bang for the buck.
Very good to know. I'll make some calls after this podcast and restructure my social setting. But it's very fascinating to understand these things, because I think the more we can empower ourselves with knowledge around our neuroscience, things make more sense on a day-to-day basis, don't they? So with that in mind, from a relationships point of view, from a conventional relationships point of view, your background in couples, marriage counseling, there's a lot of white noise in the Western world. There's a lot of things that we need to process, a lot of things being fed to us that are difficult to comprehend. So what were the general things that you noticed from a relationship point of view between males and females, or same-sex marriages or same-sex relationships, that were clearly defined within the parameters in which you assign to attachment? So if you place a secure person alongside an anxious attachment person, what does that equal?
Absolutely.
That sort of equation.
To dive into this, let me dive into a real quick topic about men and women and some brief differences. I spoke at depth in this on my attachment bootcamp course on my website, adamlanesmith.com. But there's two different ways that men and women really bond, especially at the beginning of a relationship. And they are each trying to bond the other one to them in that way. And it just doesn't work in the Western world. Women try to bond men to them using oxytocin, which is why women will jump into bed fairly quickly. Many women here in the Western world will, I should say, hoping that if they have really good bedroom experiences, it will bond the men to them the way a woman would bond, getting oxytocin release. It would make them feel closer. And those women are often very disappointed when those men don't develop emotional romantic feelings for them. They develop dopamine bonds more toward those women. And the men view them as like, hey, that was a really nice hamburger to eat. Now I'm not hungry, so I'm going to go play Xbox. I'll come back when I'm hungry again. Instead of, I am in love with this woman. Men bond first through vasopressin is how we really bond the best. So bonding through solving problems together, overcoming challenges together, this is how men really bond first. And then we want to emotionally invest with oxytocin bonding second, because now we can afford the time to invest in somebody that we want to keep around. Our brain says this person's a trusted ally and a great asset. Let me keep them in my life by bonding through oxytocin. Women tend to be the opposite. They want to oxytocin bond first through warmth and care and lack of stress. And then once they've established that they can trust you not to abandon them in the middle of a challenge, then they will vasopress and bond with you and go through experiences with you and challenges. We're two ships passing in the night. Now, when you track this onto avoidant attachment and anxious attachment will come in, and women often have anxious attachment more than men do. Women will come in eager for approval. And at the same time, that means to them oxytocin bonding. So they come in oxytocin bonding, trying to be useful to him. And the best way that they know here in the Western world is through bedroom and fun experience and making him feel good and making him feel like he has her attention. And men just don't really connect much that way. Men come in, especially men who have a lot more avoidant attachment styles, and they don't solve problems with other people. In fact, they keep other people at arm's length and say, no, I'm not interested in opening up and connecting my vulnerabilities here. I don't want to show you who I am. I'm me. I have my problems. You have yours. Stay over there and solve them yourself. And women take on so much emotional intimacy through sharing of problems and sharing of concerns, not even solving them, but bonding over them and sharing them and being vulnerable, that when men with avoidant issues don't do this, after the first 6 to 12 months of the relationship, the female drive shifts from short-term gain to long-term maintenance and stability. And her brain says, okay, he is not emotionally bonding with me. If I happen to get pregnant, he will abandon me and my child. So I'm going to crank the sex drive way down because I'm not getting much oxytocin bonding. And he has no idea what has happened. And neither does she, really. They start struggling at 6 to 12 months. And this is where a lot of couples, when they have that dynamic, they start struggling really bad. It gets worse if and when they have kids together, because she shifts again and has more oxytocin and he has no idea what's going on. So then she views him as a threat to the kids because he's not bonding to them. And the kids are now picking up anxious attachment problems from him and she blames him. All of this is the male-female dynamic here in the West. And it's built on our differences, but it's also built on the way that these attachment issues are making our differences a liability instead of a benefit.
So what are the low hanging fruits that you work with people on to try and begin to repair these? Because it sounds like it's quite systemic and embedded within society. It's not as if anyone's at blame here for what these things are, because it could be framed as one person's decision is ignorant of the other person's needs or requirements, which is often something that is spoken about in media terms, I guess. I think you could probably go open a Cosmopolitan and see those phrases used in that setting. But what is the process for somebody beginning to, one, understand, and then, two, repair that so that you can actually cultivate a happier, healthier Absolutely. Relationship?
So the first step that I always give people is you got to work on your anxiety levels enough to be able to face some of these fears, because these are built in from childhood. Like first hour of life up to the first 12 years of life, your brain is learning if people will love you or not. That, like, the moment you are born, does mom love me? Do I get physical contact? Do I get care and nurturing? Was I put in the NICU over here, the intensive care unit for babies, and put in there for 3 weeks and crying with little physical contact? Was I put in daycare way early and with strangers and had to compete with other kids for attention? Did my parents come home exhausted? They spend time with me. Breastfeeding goes into this. That's a huge oxytocin thing and bonding. Over here in America, especially, we've had this huge push toward formula. And now we're seeing all these kids with attachment issues all of a sudden, formula and early daycare. And then parental depression, parental anxiety, parental attachment issues, divorce, splitting up marriages, people not even getting married, and all kinds of problems over here has led to this massive rise. And the way to fix that is to go through the fear of, this has been a problem in my brain since before I could even form thoughts. I am irrationally terrified of being rejected or abandoned or hurt. So I think I'm going to die if I open myself up to another human being. So step zero, learn to manage the anxiety enough to then open up to one human being and explain the thoughts and feelings that you're having and what these irrational fears are, and say what I call, I am an anxious person speech. You may not know this about me, but I'm an anxious person. I try to stay safe from rejection or hurt in relationships. And it makes me do things and say things that maybe I don't mean, or I run away, or I try to people please and I hate it and I don't ever want to do it again. Can we please have an honest relationship, you and me, for the rest of our lives together? And this is the most terrifying conversation a person will have throughout their life, because it's very terrifying. And they're opening up for the first time, and the other person always, almost always says, yes, that sounds great. I didn't really know it was that bad, but I knew you had some anxiety. Let's work on this. Great. Yeah, let's be friends. And it's this rush of brain chemicals you were supposed to be getting for the last 20, 30 years of your life. And you experience tremendous relief and changes. And people come back into coaching sessions with me after that and say, Adam, I don't even know how to describe this feeling. Is this really how it feels just to be loved? And I say, dude, you've only had one conversation. This is only the beginning. And then you go back out, you test it again, and you test it, and you lean into your relationships. And every time you're honest, you'll be terrified. Then you'll receive that reassurance and acceptance, and it heals you again and again and again. And you need someone to walk with you through this process, which is why I do coaching, and I have a whole group, the Attachment Circle, built on helping people through this. But it's you need somebody to guide you through it, because it feels so terrifying, and at times you want to stop. But this is how you heal, is by experiencing that love and challenging all the fears that you've held all those years.